Well, welcome. This is the second talk tonight on hereditary breast cancer testing. And I'm Dr. Hoberman, and my practice is Liberty Surgical Associates. And I'm blessed enough to have Ashley Mitchell as my nurse practitioner. And together we do a lot of breast cancer evaluation, risk assessment, high-risk breast clinic, in addition to the other things that we do as a general surgery office. So we have a passion and a focus for breast care. And so as a part of that, really when I started the practice and taking care of the breast cancer patients, it was kind of a natural thing to want to look at family history and decide and help women be well informed with the decisions that they were making with respect to their breast cancer with their family history. And so I've done genetic testing for about 5 years in my private practice. And then in the last couple of years, with a stronger focus in the high-risk patients, we had more and more young ladies coming to us saying, well, I don't have cancer, but it runs in my family, and can you talk to me about my risks? And that sort of thing, that we really developed the high-risk breast clinic so that we could have a place for them to be cared for and to be watched over. And then in that population, to figure out who as well needs to be tested for whether or not they carry the gene. And so we do have patients in that clinic who are just at increased risk because of their family history, and we have ladies in that clinic who have tested positive for the gene, and that we're watching that way. So when we talk about hereditary breast cancer and the testing, in your pamphlet you've got a couple of different tools, and there's the one that starts out with, is hereditary cancer testing right for you? And when we think about hereditary cancers in general, when you look at that family history, there's lots of the same cancer. You can see that cancer could be passed down from parent to child, and they're related cancers. And often they happen at an earlier age than average what you would expect for that given cancer. Then there are cancers that are considered sporadic. They just really happen by chance. When you look at the relatives in a family, they tend to be different cancers, or just one cancer out of the blue within those families. And then when you look at familial cancers, we think those are probably a combination of some genetic and environmental factors and that sort of thing. And that's probably the vast majority of risks that ladies look at are just at increase because of familial type cancers. It's not clearly passed down from generation to generation. The hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome, we call it HBOC, and it's really an inherited condition that puts women and men at increased risk for various cancers, including ovarian, breast, pancreatic, and prostate cancer. The vast majority are due to defects in the BRCA1 and 2 genes, and so that's what we're going to kind of concentrate on tonight. When you take a look, and I like this table, it shows very clearly like the general population risk versus if you carried the gene, and this is what really gets our attention. So for a lady who carries the BRCA gene, her breast cancer risk can be up to 87%, where the average risk is 11%. Ovarian cancer can be as high as 44% versus the general population less than 1%. Male breast cancer can be up to 8%, and initially that doesn't seem like, oh, such a high percentage, until you realize that male breast cancers in the general population are 0.05%, exceedingly rare.
Have you ever seen?
Okay. Yeah. A second breast cancer in a woman who carries the gene, it can be up to 64% versus the average risk of a woman who's had breast cancer getting a second separate primary cancer is only 11%. And then some other cancers like pancreatic and prostate also associated with this gene, and increased incidences definitely higher than, you know, the general population. Pancreatic is less than 1%, and prostate should be, you know, 13% or less. But boy, if you carry the gene, it is higher.
I have a question about the different types of breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The in situ ductal carcinoma, which is stage 0, is that considered?
It's still considered a cancer for testing purposes. That's a great question. Yeah, that, and women say, do I have to just have an invasive cancer, you know, at a given age? Nope, it does count for in situ cancers.
Mm-hmm.
When we take a look at a woman's testing options, I think it's really important that when you get your counseling, that it's by somebody who has experience. Any physician or provider can send off the test, but it's really trying to figure out in the family history who should be tested. So when Ashley and I see patients, we do a three-generation pedigree. We're taking a look at who is the most appropriate person in that family to be tested. Sometimes it's not the patient who initially came in to see us, but it could be their sister, their mother, their father, someone else in the family. So we certainly like to help hone in on who the most appropriate person to test is. Ashley and I, in the last year, we got accepted to a program at City of Hope Cancer Hospital out in California. So we did an intensive 3-month program and then went out to California for some additional testing and finalizing that certificate. So that was really nice. It gave us a broader sense of not only BRCA testing, but some of the other cancer syndromes that we like to take a look at for our patients as well. Myriad is the company that's done the vast majority of testing. A lot of people heard about this in the news when they lost their patent on the cancer gene testing. So now we have kind of this flood of other companies coming into the market. Not that they aren't good testing, we just don't have the long-term data with those companies like we do with Myriad. And because they're the most common tester, I talked about the tests with the names that they use. So that's why I talk about here the four types of genetic testing is based on the Myriad names and how the BRCA mutation is looked at. The most common test and where we start is the comprehensive testing for most women. And that's a real full examination of the most common changes in those two genes. There's a new additional testing that's being done called BART testing. It's still looking at the BRCA1 and 2 gene, but in past years, if somebody in your family maybe had BRCA testing, an important part to know is it, you know, up to today's standard and is it complete testing is to find out if they had BART testing done as a portion of that. Single-site gene testing, that's when we just look at a known mutation in a family. So when patients come into us with a copy of a family member's testing and say, well, this is what runs in our family, can I be tested for this? Then we just test that single site if that's what's most appropriate for them. And so certainly, like we talked about here, a copy of that positive test result really helps. If patients have a Jewish history, then there's a common test that we do for those folks. It's called the multi-site 3 testing, and we can go into that in more detail if anyone has Jewish ancestry that we need to take a look at. When we go through these test results and we send them out, when they come back, we like to have a sit-down discussion with you about those test results because they can come back as positive, negative, or an uncertain variant. And you have to be kind of prepared for any of those answers. A positive test result means that, yep, like on that table, you're at increased risk for those cancers, and we put together a plan for how we're going to watch you for each of those cancers, so it's increased monitoring. For some women, it can be medication to help reduce their risk, and for other women, they may choose risk-reducing surgery. And so we can talk to patients about all of those options. We also want to prepare you to help share those results with family members, so to help prepare and have a letter that can be sent out. Sometimes patients will also send a copy of their test results to their close relatives to say, you know, I want you to know that if you want to go and talk with your physician, here's my test results. This is what other folks in the family need to be tested for or to have this information if they want to be tested. So that's important to help you educate your family when you do test positive. A negative result is wonderful. Now, if there's a situation where there's a known BRCA mutation and a patient comes in and gets tested for that single site and doesn't have that single site mutation, then really they have, even if it's like a mother and a daughter, mother carries the gene, daughter gets tested, she doesn't have that mutation, her risk then goes down to the average population. She doesn't have to have increased MRIs. She doesn't have to have increased, you know, mammograms other than standard population. So there's a real freedom and a beauty in knowing that it's a negative when it's an appropriate, you know, analyzed negative in the family. Now, there are some patients, they come in and they test negative or they come to us having testing done elsewhere and say, well, what does this negative really mean? You know, if it's in a family where, let's say, the mother died at a very early age from breast cancer and a daughter comes in and says, yeah, I lost my mom, you know, at age 42 from breast cancer and now I'd like to be tested and I've got 6 sisters, what do we do? Well, the mom, if she carried that gene, it's 50-50 whether it would go to each child. All 6 of those children need to be tested to know. So even though one daughter comes in and is testing negative, we can't say that that infers anything to the sisters. And I think some of those nuances sometimes get lost when families are counseled. So we want to explain what that negative result means for you and your other family members. And then the other thing is an uncertain variant. There are genetic defects that occur in the BRCA1 and 2 genes, or changes in the protein sequences, so to speak, that we don't know if they're good or bad. We can see in a family that maybe they have this variation, but we haven't seen that variation enough times to say if it's good or bad. So then you're given this variant classification. One of the things that Ashley and I really like about the Myriad company as compared to other companies is they have this huge variation program where they're watching and analyzing all these different results that come through, and then they notify us, they'll notify the patient if they get reclassified. And that's huge. Some of the other companies that are just doing the testing may have higher number of variants that they're reporting out, and they're not necessarily giving us that long-term data yet. So one of the reasons when you look at, hey, what company is even going to be my testing going to be done? Some patients don't know that there are multiple companies, and some insurances are steering patients in one direction or the other, and I think patients need to be well informed as to which company is doing their testing. They may choose a different company than their insurance carrier maybe is leaning towards at the time. And then Ashley's going to go over the rest of the things in the packet as far as our genetic assessment tool.
So there is in your packet a questionnaire that you can look at, and it guides us in who's appropriate for testing. So the majority of breast cancers are sporadic, so most don't have this genetic link. So we have specific guidelines that have been developed by the National Comprehensive Cancer Network that are followed, and these are the guidelines that are typically followed by insurance companies as well in terms of covering testing. And they help us determine who is appropriate. So with someone who has breast cancer, or if you have a family member with breast cancer, if they were diagnosed at a younger age. So typically, not always, but typically women with a BRCA mutation will have cancer at a younger age. It's really defined as a premenopausal breast cancer, but the age number that's placed on that is 45. So if it's 45 or less, then that person would be appropriate to pursue genetic testing. If you were diagnosed at the age of 50 or a family member at the age of 50 or less, and then there's another family member who is younger than 50, then they would be appropriate for testing as well. And if you were diagnosed at age 50 or less and had a relative with an ovarian cancer, and that would include a fallopian tube cancer also, and then peritoneal cancer, which really with a peritoneal cancer, they have a hard time determining the origin of that particular cancer. It is not linked with uterine or cervical cancer. So a lot of times people will come in and they'll be like, well, they had one of those cancers, but it's important to know which it was. Was it ovarian? Was it uterine or cervical? Now, if a woman has had two separate breast cancers, then they'd be appropriate also, as Dr. Hoberman had pointed out, that women with these mutations have a significantly higher risk of developing a second breast cancer over someone who doesn't have a mutation who's had breast cancer. Another newer guideline is someone who's had a triple negative breast cancer. So there are certain receptors and characteristics that they look at with the breast tumor. And with a triple negative cancer, they seem to be, it's a more rare type of cancer, but they seem to be more common in women with BRCA mutations. So if a woman is 60 or younger with a cancer with those characteristics, then they would qualify for testing as well. We also come into situations where we just don't have a lot of family history. We have someone who was diagnosed with cancer, and they were adopted, and so we don't have any family history. If they were 50 or younger, then they would be appropriate for testing. Or we may have a family where there just aren't a lot of females. So say dad's mom, so grandma on dad's side, had breast cancer, but your dad had no sister, so you have no aunts on that side. If you have no one in your family, no other females who lived past age 45, and grandma was 50 or younger when she had her breast cancer, then testing would be appropriate. And then a male relative. So we think about the BRCA mutation in relation to women, but half of the people who have a mutation are men and half are women. And so men have increased risk for cancers as well. So it's important for men to be tested, but also if you have a relative with a male breast cancer, then testing would be appropriate. And then Dr. Hoberman touched on the Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. The general population, 1 in 400 women have a BRCA mutation, or people, I should say. And within the Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, it's 1 in 40. So they have this very much increased risk for having a BRCA mutation. And it's typically one of three specific mutations, and that's what they test for when they do testing on that patient population. Let's say you personally don't have breast or ovarian cancer, or excuse me, you personally don't have breast cancer, but you had a family member who did, then you could be tested. It's always best to test the person who's had the cancer, but if that's not a possibility, we can test the family members. Any woman who's had a personal history of ovarian cancer is eligible for testing. 1 in 8 women who have ovarian cancer have a BRCA mutation. So they would meet qualifications for testing. And then any man who's had a breast cancer would meet the criteria too. New this year is the addition of pancreatic cancer. They found that there is some increased risk for pancreatic cancer. So if someone has pancreatic cancer and then they have two or more relatives who've had breast or ovarian cancer, then testing would be appropriate also. And then, of course, if there's a mutation in the family, then you'd be appropriate to be tested for that specific genetic mutation. And there's a 50-50 chance in terms of someone inheriting that. So if mom has it, all of her kids would have a 50-50 chance of having it. So if my mom had the mutation and I don't have it, there's no way that I would pass that on to my children. It would stop there. But if I did have it, then I would have a 50-50 chance of passing it on to my children. And that kind of ties in with what you talked about at the last talk about in terms of the age of testing. It's something that's done when people are adults. So we wait until someone is at least 18 years of age to do testing. It's not something parents decide for their children. These are adult onset cancers. So we want it to be the individual's decision as to whether or not they would like to pursue testing. For those individuals, I mean, screening doesn't typically start until the age of 25, so it's not something that needs to be done when they're young, you know, younger than 18. So, also, oh, yeah.
Both of us love
yeah.
to no to all of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
We're
yeah.
pretty good.
Yes. You wouldn't, yeah, you wouldn't meet also guidelines. And yeah, yep.
70s.
Right.
She was diagnosed and I was late.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I know, exactly. So, yeah, if there were additional, like if there were three family members with breast cancer or breast ovarian, yeah, then exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
None of them had any issues.
Sure.
My age.
Yep. So that's great. Yeah, sigh of relief, I know. And so in the packet, there's also just information about Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. A lot of people are hesitant to get testing because they fear that there's going to be discrimination against them. So there's a federal and state protection in terms of health insurance and employment. It does not extend to life insurance policies. And I don't know of any documented cases so far of life insurance discrimination. I don't know if that could become more prevalent in the future as more and more genetic testing is being done. So we usually just ask our patients to have some life insurance in place, you know, prior to being tested. So anything, any questions that we can answer or...
When we were upstairs, I'm sorry, this is about the conversation.
That's all right.
Sure.
She was talking about alcohol moderation. Do you remember what she said about that?
Less than one glass a day.
a day.
Okay.
And she said, so there's that whole conflict between drinking red wine, which reduces your heart risk, but then drinking red wine can increase your breast cancer risk.
I didn't hear if she said per day or per week. So.
No, it's per day.
Okay.
So one more thing to go do.
But you're doing great on the exercise,
there
so you
go.
Get like double points for that.
That's my double point. So not so good on the stress management, but the exercise we've got.
Well, good.
How long does it take? Like when it gets
That's a good question. Yeah, once it gets done, you know, for patients who come in and they have a cancer and we're trying to use that testing to help them decide what cancer surgery they're going to do, we can expedite that testing. And we're really lucky. We usually get it back within, you know, less than 2 weeks.
Yeah,
and sometimes it's even a week to 10 days. So, and that's kind of what we need. We need to be able to have those test results expedited when a woman's trying to decide, you know, do I have lumpectomy? Do I have mastectomy? Do I have double mastectomy? What's my risk of another breast cancer? And so it can certainly be overwhelming at times as we're doing that counseling for a woman who comes in with what she thought was a small early cancer, but when you look at her family history, it's terrible. And as you start to unfold that to say, well, I want you to have everything at your disposal as you're making these decisions, but we can get those results back really quite quickly. And we test either buccal swab, so the cells lining the cheek, or blood testing can be done both ways. We tend to do the buccal in our office.
The typical turnover for a non-urgent matter is about 3 to 4 weeks right now.
Mm-hmm.
Since Angelina Jolie made headlines, it's slowed the process down a little bit.
But in a way, what a beautiful thing that she would share
absolutely.
That, because I think there were a lot of women, and even in our own practice, who said, well, you know, they couldn't wrap their minds around, did they want to do this testing? And when they see somebody that, you know, they can connect with, and they say, oh, wow, well, she did go through with the testing. And for her, it went one way. But for them, you know, a lot of these ladies that most people work at are going to test negative, you know, then that can be really freeing, too.
And a lot of, oh, go ahead.
I was just thinking about the logistics. It's usually covered in your sample. It like, doesn't prevent you from getting coverage with that label.
Right, in terms of insurance, health insurance.
And job discrimination.
Right, so for group health insurance, they can't discriminate based on a positive test result. I think the healthcare, as you know, system is changing significantly, but there's this big push against pre-existing conditions. I'm hopeful that that will...
You know, yeah,
reduce
I hope
any,
people who try and get a standalone policy,
right.
if they're an entrepreneur and have their own business and want to just get a standalone policy, that's where, in theory, they may not be denied, but they might be charged more or difference in coverage that way. But a group policy, they're safe.
But if you're buying your own health insurance, then there's potential.
Being charged extra.
Yeah.
I have a non-genetic question.
Sure.
Okay. When you do a mastectomy, most times, do you do reconstruction at the same time?
We try to.
This is what I'm confused. What tissue do you use, and why could it not come back to that tissue? Is it because it's not breast tissue?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are three kinds of breast reconstruction that we do. The first and the easiest to heal from is implant reconstruction. So when we do a mastectomy, we're really leaving the outer skin of the breast, about a centimeter of fatty tissue that carries the blood vessels to keep the skin alive, and where that breast actually comes up and connects to the underlying skin, we're taking or kind of shelling out all of that breast tissue. We usually say with mastectomy, we probably remove about 95 to 97% of the breast tissue that's underneath the skin. And so once we take that away to rebuild that breast, we can do it, like I said, one of three ways. Implant is where we put the sac filled with silicone, filled with saline, to be the breast mound. And usually that's put in a position underneath your chest muscle, your pectoralis muscle. So then we have skin, fat, we have pectoralis muscle, and we have implant. The only place a breast cancer can come back is in that 3 to 5% of breast cells where they were attached underneath the skin. So it's going to be something you can feel. It's right underneath the skin. It feels hard. It feels firm. And ladies just can feel it very easily on self-exam. We don't do mammograms. We don't usually do screening MRIs on somebody with a mastectomy because the only breast cells that are left are really right underneath the skin. So that's a great question, but that's where it comes back.
Okay.
So yeah, in the implant, in the muscle, it's not going to be of origin there. It's got to be the breast cells okay. that remain.
But you still use a lot of implants.
Yes, we do. That's by far the number one reconstruction method that we use. Probably 2 and 3 then would be a latissimus flap, which is muscle off the back. It's a thin muscle. We just tend to use that to reconstruct ladies who have had to have radiation before their reconstruction. Because when radiated chest wall, skin, that radiation keeps the skin from stretching, the muscle from stretching, and usually ladies are flat. They've had their mastectomy, they get radiation, then they want reconstruction. So they need extra skin, and then they need also muscle coverage of the implant. And so then we'll use the muscle off their back and still wrap it around an implant. So latissimus off your back has to be paired with an implant. The last way to avoid, like if ladies don't want to have an implant, is to use belly wall muscle, and that's called a tram flap. They use the rectus muscle. The rectus muscle are our two big belly muscles. And, you know, when we're pregnant, they kind of move to the side, and then we always hope they come back. Well, you can imagine if you take one of them away to make a breast, it leaves the belly wall with some laxity. Initially, ladies love it because it's kind of like a tummy tuck. They're pretty tight, but over the long term, they can be prone to hernias and some weakness and laxity of that belly wall. So some women don't choose it for that reason. It does give a nice reconstruction. It's a very soft, natural-looking breast, but there are some consequences. It's a long recovery. It's the longest recovery. You know, if we think of things in that terms, the tram flap is at least a 6-week recovery because you're recovering from breast reconstruction and essentially a tummy tuck. Yeah, so those are the three ways. Yeah, but anything that comes back has got to be those breast cells that were left. And we know we can never get 100% of the breast tissue removed, and that's frustrating. We wish we could, but we can't when we have to leave some skin for coverage there. It's a good question. Anything else? Any other burning questions? Even if it's not genetic related, we love any kind of educational question. We're good with it. No? All right. Anything you wanted to add?
I was just going to say, because you had said you have had breast cancer previously, so if you were ever interested in knowing your risk just based on your family, that's something that we can calculate. So there's different computer models available, and it uses your, we take your family history, so we'd write out your family tree, put that information in along with the personal history as well, and that would give us a percentage, your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. And so when that number is 20% or greater, then you'd qualify for some additional screening methods. So that's kind of that familial risk where we, you know, it's most likely not genetic related, but there's still maybe within the family some increased risk of developing breast cancer. So
does that mean like a terminal prostate cancer could
No.
In that family,
mm-hmm.
No, just
right.
Okay.
Well, thanks. So ladies that we see in our high-risk breast clinic are the ones that have that lifetime risk over 20%. Right. They're the ones that were getting MRIs and alternating with mammograms and doing a breast exam every 6 months for. And they have maybe no genetic risk.
And they don't even recommend that for me.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So
because your risk of a second breast cancer is pretty low,
right?
11%.
11%. So the MRI is indicated when there's a risk of 20% or greater. But for an individual, we don't know that risk until we get those a few personal questions. It's based on age of when you started your period, if you've had any children. All of those different factors go into those risk model calculations. Along with family history, so
it's really easy. They did it, but you did it in like 3 minutes with me.
Yeah,
very informative and helpful.
Good. All right. Well, I think the next part of the night is outside under the tent.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you for coming and listening.